Hi, welcome to Neuroverse, a podcast hosted by Carolina
and Clara, where we discuss all matters from neuroscience to philosophy and beyond.
Today's episode is on the neural computation of naturalistic behaviors, and we're joined today by Professor Tiago Branco, who studied medicine in Lisbon and then completed a PhD at UCL with Yukiko Goda, working on synaptic release probability. He then did his postdoctoral research with Michael Hauser, where he investigated how single neurons integrate different spatiotemporal patterns of synaptic input, looking at the role of dendritic active mechanisms in this process. Tiago is currently a PI at Sainsbury Wellcome Centre, researching how instinctive decisions are computed from sensory information and form representations of the world built from experience, using a top-down approach to study how ion channels and synapses give rise to the neural dynamics that govern behavioral choices. Welcome to the podcast, Tiago.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Really exciting. So I think I'd like to start off maybe in the beginning and ask why you moved from medicine into neuroscience research.
So I never really wanted to do medicine. So this was the 90s in Lisbon. If you wanted to do neuroscience, there was no way of doing neuroscience. There's no neuroscience degree. The closest thing that there was biology. Biology in Lisbon was focused on plant research, and then there was biochemistry, which, you know, you had to do it, biochemistry. The medical school in Lisbon actually had a very strong research kind of ethos and a bunch of departments that were doing biomedical research. And so that's why I went there, to do biomedical research. Medicine at the same time, but that was the main reason. And so, when I finished medical school, then I always worked in laboratories throughout medical school, from year one to I guess year six. And my plan was always to kind of leave and go into a PhD. So it was kind of during the time while you're in medical school, you kind of have second thoughts. Well, this could be interesting, but then research is more interesting.
Of course, yeah. So then, you wrote an essay and won the Eppendorf Prize about dendrites, and I was hoping you could tell us a bit about your research in relation to dendrites in Michael Hauser's lab at UCL.
Yes, I guess the starting point for the work is the overarching question of that whole field is, what can a neuron compute, right? How powerful is a neuron? And the variable view is that a neuron has a soma and can integrate synaptic inputs up to a threshold and then fire an action potential. So you integrate to a threshold, and it's a very simple computation, which is still to the day, like whenever we approximate neurons and neural networks, that this is how we approximate neurons. But it has been known for a long time that neurons have dendrites and make things very complicated and add a spatial dimension to the problem of spatial integration and add a lot of opportunities for making things more complicated. But if you make things more complicated, it means that you can in principle perform more complex computations. You can have all sorts of nonlinearities that arise from the dendrite itself or from ion channels that exist in the dendrites. And so the question that we asked was at that time was to what kind of things can neurons compute using dendrites? We already knew quite a lot about that dendrites, for example. The existing view at the time was, when I started the postdoc, was that because you have dendrites, you can actually get, and dendrites can fire on their own things like action potentials, called dendritic spikes. It means that you can actually have two stages of integration. You can have dendrites deciding for themselves whether they're going to fire something or not, and then that goes to the soma, and then the soma integrates that and fires it out. So it basically approximates a two-layer network. And what we asked at the beginning of my postdoc was, well, can we, there was a very old prediction by Wilfred Rawl that a single cable, like a single dendrite, could be used to detect, compute a sequence. So if you activate inputs 1, 2, 3, 4, or 4, 3, 2, 1, that the dendrite, by just its passive properties, could do this computation. So I just set out to test that, because we had this technique at the time that was emerging, where it was called two-fold multimodal caging. You can use it to activate synapses in a specific spatial temporal order. So that's the reason why people hadn't done the experiment before, because it's actually, we couldn't do it with electrical stimulation. It's very, very hard. So you kind of want a way of just pinpointing these exact synapses that you're going to activate. So we just had fun doing that. And that's the first experiment I did in the lab. It's going to replicate Wall's experiment. And activate a bunch of synapses up the dendrite and down the dendrite, and then found that the response was indeed different. The catch was that it was not. So Rawl had predicted that you could do this in a passive dendrite, that you can, I'm sure, but you need a really long dendrite. And dendrites in the cortex are, not electrotonically as long, so you would need the dendrite in a basal dendrite in a layer 2-3 neuron is something like 500 microns, 50 microns. And for you to be able to exploit the mechanism that Rawl proposed, you needed the dendrite is about a millimeter. But what we found is that dendrites have an NMDA receptors that actually exploit the basic passive properties of the neurons that actually allowed for this computation to be performed in the mesh of the dendrite. And so the upshot of that kind of main study was that you can get dendrites to discriminate between different temporal sequences, not just up and down, actually more other types of sequences, which is quite fun because it's a pretty complex computation actually. Just speaking out different response depending on the spatial, on the temporal order of input is actually fairly complicated, and so it's quite exciting to see that neurons could do that. And then the other kind of main thing we did was to then show also that the same mechanism could be used to integrate input in a different way. For example, if you have input really close to the soma, you need very precise, the whole thing is very precise, like you need inputs to arrive very coincident in time in order to drive the neuron to fire. Whereas if they're out in the dendrite, you act as a longer term integration where you can have inputs kind of spread in time and it doesn't matter so much. This still the integration time constant is very long. And that's all due to a combination of the basic biophysical properties of the neurons and of the dendrite, and because they have things like NMDA receptors. So the upshot is, neurons can compute very complicated things. It doesn't mean that they do, but we can certainly get them to all sorts of tricks in the slice.
That's so cool.
Yeah, and it sounds so technically challenging as well.
Yes, it was, but yes, we needed a microscope, we needed two lasers, and point them to the hardest thing was to point them to the right location and making sure that things didn't move.
Yeah, but I think it's also such a good example of like bringing the computational models to the experimental and then finding, like how you said, they couldn't technically do it because the dendritic length was too short, but then they could because they had these NMDA receptors. And I love these little biological peculiarities that like enable computational predictions to happen, but in a way you wouldn't expect it to.
Yeah, and it's true actually. Modeling there, even so, we did a lot of modeling to interpret the data. Actually, that's one of the things that kept me awake at night for a long time. Was like, why does this work? How does this work? Mm-hmm. And it's very hard. I knew that they depend on an NDA because you can block an NDA and it goes away. But it was not completely obvious, at least for me at the time, how does it work? And so we did a lot of modeling. And modeling is really fun because you can go and do all sorts of experiments in a model that you can't do in real life. You can play with the concentration of an NDA receptors. You can play with the diameter of the dendrite. You can make dendrites that don't exist but have special properties. If you want to test whether, the memory resistance is important for this thing. You can go and change the memory resistance. You can't do that in everyone. So by doing that, we then eventually came up with the model that we have, that we think this works this way because it's a model that can reproduce it very well.
And I also found it interesting that you said we know that neurons can do these things, not that they necessarily do these things.
Yeah.
So I know a lot of your recent research is about animal behavior and the neural computations underlying it. So how did you make that switch, or like how did you change your research focus from this very small scale dendritic computation to more behaviorally relevant?
Yeah, that's exactly because of what I just said.
Exactly
because of that, right? And you picked up well. So, you know, we do all this research. We've done all this research that tells us what neurons can do, right? Then, you know, for example, what we demonstrated that, you know, if you activate 10 synapses in an orderly sequence, the neuron spits out a different thing depending on sequence. But it might be that this never happened, right?
Yeah.
That when you have a neuron receiving 10,000 synapses and, you know, all hell's breaking loose, that this mechanism actually can't be used to compute anything that is relevant for the animal. And there's many, I think there's many examples of things that we have found. So there's tons and tons of work on simple neuron physiology. And I think we understand neurons extremely well. There are things that we don't know, but I think we understand them very, very well. And I think what we need to do now is try to understand how these wonderful biophysical mechanisms are actually used to compute things that matter for the animal. And I, you know, I actually say that there's a lot of things that we found out, that we have found out by researching single neuron physiology that are probably never actually going to be used for anything useful. And so, at some point, I think you really want to ask what things are useful. And so, there's many ways you can do that, but I think when I started my lab, I just started, okay, well, I'm going to start from the top instead. So, you know, instead of starting from the bottom and say, okay, I found this mechanism, and now I'm going to try to find out what this thing might be useful for. Which may or may not. The problem there is that if you're not honest with yourself, you always end up saying, oh no, this is really important. This is the most important thing that the brain does, right? And this is the most important mechanism. And you know, maybe it's not. So the alternative is start from the top. You say, okay, look, I'm going to start with something that I think it's interesting, either a behavior or a computation of some sort, like I don't know, the computation of orientation selectivity or something. And then you go down and try and find a mechanism. The idea being, or the hoping, that by the time you get down to the neuron or the synapse, you have some sort of security there that, okay, I'm trying to explain this thing that matters at the higher level, right?
Yeah.
And then you go and look for a mechanism, whatever that mechanism might be. And maybe it's an NMDA receptor, or maybe not. Maybe it has nothing to do with it, and just the way the circuit is organized and wired. Right?
Yeah.
So it's just a different approach, and that's why I said, okay, well, I'm going to try this one.
In that approach, how easy is it to reduce it to a synaptic or subcellular level mechanism? Because isn't it easier to kind of find a neural circuit and just get stuck there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's hard, right? I think, yes, the short answer is it's actually very hard, and you have to get very lucky to be able to get there, and even then, it's because in the mouse. So let's make a disclaimer: important. All research that I have done so far is in the mouse, and in a system like the mouse, a mammalian system, the challenge is that all computations are heavily distributed across the brain, so it is always going to be really hard to, you know, identify one circuit, one synaptic connection that is the most important thing, right? And I think, and maybe that doesn't exist. So it is extremely hard. So our approach to that has been, all right, let's start with a really simple behavior, which is escape behavior, which is really ancient, really primordial, with the hope that thing might be coordinated by only a handful neural circuits, at least at the basic level, that we can hope to then go and pin down some synapse that's important, right? And that was kind of part of the rationale to go down to a very, very simple behavior, like to minimize. Let's try to get something that is interesting that doesn't require the whole brain working at the same time.
Yeah.
That was the rationale. It's probably not true. But so it is, I think it's very hard, and that's why I think, you know, other systems, if you want to do that kind of thing, have advantages, like Drosophila, for example. It's a phenomenal system to get down to the synaptic level and understanding of computation.
Yeah, it seems like with neuroscience, no matter how simple of a system you try to make it, there's always so much complexity beyond our understanding.
Yeah.
Yes, even in, you know, even in the C. Eliot's, right?
Yeah.
You know, we have the connecting, it has kind of two neurons, and it's, the problem is you can go from one neuron to any other neuron in 3 synapses, I think, and you have motor modulation on top that changes everything, and then just understanding that is extremely complicated. Now, if you scale that to a mammalian brain, where again, I think you can go from one neuron to any other neuron in something like 7 synapses, it's very complicated.
Yeah.
So, you recently published a paper about mice identifying sub-goal locations through action-driven mapping processes,
mm-hmm.
and I found it really interesting, the use of experimental work but also modeling work, as we've spoken about. And it was interesting, one of the observations of the paper, that the experimental work and the mice, they learned a lot faster than the AI modeling did.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a bit about this, and I guess what the benefits are of experimental work and potentially the shortcomings of language models?
Yeah, so that was an interesting exercise. So that's kind of a general observation. I mean, this is an observation that is, I guess, very animals, and especially humans, are extremely good at learning really quickly and generalizing
mm-hmm.
very fast, which is something that is also well known that artificial agents have a hard time doing, because they have to see a lot of data and a lot of repetitions to learn. So that's a fundamental disconnect. I mean, this is a very well known and problem,
mm-hmm.
right? And in many ways, you can argue that it's unfair on the AI systems, because we have, I don't know how many millions of years of evolution that has shaped our brains to with some, I guess, preconceptions about the world that facilitate our ability to extract information about it. And I think this example of the obstacles is a good one, which is, you know, if you put an animal in an environment, environment, in this case was a, you know, there's a little shelter and there's an obstacle, they don't like run around randomly, like bumping their heads into things and forgetting about it, which is how you design an anomaly, your vanilla reinforcement learning agent. That's what it does, right?
Yeah.
But a mouse won't do that. A mouse will look around, see something salient, and go and explore it. Right? Nobody told this mouse to do this. This is the result of evolution.
Yeah.
But that's a good thing, right? Because by doing so, they spend more time evaluating things that might be interesting rather than just walking around randomly in void, right? So that alone facilitates things, speeds up things a lot. And in that particular case, we found that actually the mice will innately run to these points of interest. And by doing so, it's easier for them to incorporate, to give them meaning. So in this case, it was the obstacle ledge, but they figured out that the obstacle ledge is actually the means that if they get there, then they can go in a straight line to the goal, which
mm-hmm.
is the shelter. And the key thing here is that we didn't teach them anything. We just let them go there, right? And they instinctively become interested in the edge, and they instinctively will make these runs, which are necessary for. And so this is the kind of thing that, you know, an artificial agent, of course, won't have, right? It starts from a tabula rasa, and some sort of learning algorithm that we've come up with to learn. And so in that, the modeling in that part, in some ways it was just an academic exercise, mm-hmm. which was what kind of, and this was in a reinforcement learning framework, what kind of learning rules we need to have in order to reproduce or to approximate the speed of learning that the mouse does. And not only the speed, but what they learn and what they don't learn. Because mm-hmm. animals actually don't. There's some things they've learned, there's some things they don't learn. And it was, in many ways, we knew what the result was going to be already, because it was obvious that things like key learning were not going to work, because they would require lots of repetitions. There are also other things that, for example, that you can make really sophisticated agents, like a complete model-based agent, that is too good and is better than the mice. Because, for example, one of the things that mice are, so there's an asymmetry in the way that mice learn about space in our conditions, which is they're very quick to learn where the shelter is, where the obstacle is. But then if you change things, they're asymmetrically slower. It takes them much longer mm-hmm. to figure out, to forget that the shelter isn't, or to learn that the shelter is not there. They'll keep going back, right? And we lower the obstacle, and the obstacle's not there, and they still go around the obstacle. And they've had enough time to figure this out. So there's a weird asymmetry that they're much slower to learn, to relearn. Whereas if you take a model-based agent, they're equally good. Right. So yeah, and this is this kind of asymmetry that was actually, we could engineer an agent that could do it, but in some ways it's kind of not really satisfactory in the sense. Okay, you have to have a bit of that, a bit of one, and a bit of the other, mm-hmm. which is fine. It's an interesting exercise to actually ask what the brain might be doing.
Yeah, and what the differences are in the ways of learning and training. I should have asked you to explain the behavioral paradigm first.
Yeah,
sure. So the behavior, So the behavioral paradigm for all experiments that we do is we take a mouse and we put it in a circular arena, which is about 1.2 meters in diameter. The mouse has never seen this arena, and there's a shelter, which is a red hut, and the mouse just kind of walks around, explores it. Normally it finds the shelter in the first 5 minutes. Once it finds a shelter, it kind of uses it as a little home base and then just keeps going out and exploring. And then at some point we scare the mouse using things like mimic something that comes from the top or a loud sound. And so these are things that are innately threatening to the animal. So the mice are just generally scared of these things. And this causes the mouse to escape to a shelter. In the case of an obstacle, we put an obstacle right in the middle of the arena, and so we scare the mouse when the mouse is the furthest away from the shelter, and there's an obstacle in between. So in order to escape the shelter, they have to run around the shelter. And because they're scared, they want to do it as quickly as possible. So the very first time we do it, they will run in the direction of the shelter, approach the barrier, and then kind of go around the long way. Whereas after a little bit of experience, they learn to target the edge of the obstacle and then go to the shelter, which means that they do this two-leg escape. So first they go from where they are to the edge of the obstacle, and then from the edge to the shelter. And that's the most efficient route. So what they learn there is that they learn that in order to get to the shelter, they can't just run towards the shelter. They actually need to go somewhere first in order to be able to then run to the shelter, which we conceptualize as learning to go to a sub-goal on the way to a goal, which is something that we have to do lots of times, right? In order to achieve whatever it is that we want, we might have to do other things in between that gives us access to the final goal. And so this is a very simple paradigm to look at this type of learning, basically.
Yeah, really interesting. And then you also use this closed loop optogenetic
mm-hmm.
System. Could you explain a bit about that? And also, what is the difference between a closed loop and an open loop?
Yeah, so a closed loop just means in general that you're performing a whatever reason to perform, in this case, optogenetic stimulation, that happens in response to something that the animal is doing. Right? So we could decide, so in an open loop experiment, if you want, we could decide, well, I'm going to stimulate this mouse every 5 minutes, regardless of what the animal is doing. In the closed loop experiment, we're going to say, well, we're going to stimulate the mouse every time the mouse is doing X. Right? Which means that we have to monitor the behavior of the animal, detect when X happens, and then tell the system to stimulate. And so that experiment was quite fun. So this is Philip Shamash, who did this, was a PhD student in my lab, who came up with this idea. Because so we had this idea that in order for mice to learn to go around the obstacle, they need to do this run. We had a model, we had some correlations, and then we wanted to test it. So the test is, well, we want to make sure that we want to prevent the animal from doing the run. And the question is, how do you do that? It's not completely trivial, because you can imagine how you're going to do it. Are you going to put another obstacle there? It doesn't quite like, and then they might learn to run along that obstacle and then the other obstacle, and then things become a little bit tricky. So what Philip thought is, okay, we're filming this animal, and we can see when it starts to run towards the obstacle edge to do these runs that we think are important for learning. And so what he said was, okay, we know if we put tranquilizer in the motor cortex, on one side of the motor cortex, and we activate it, the mouse will turn to the contralateral side. This is well known. And so he said, well, okay, maybe we should do that. Every time the mouse starts to run to the edge, we detect that, and he put like a little, he called it a virtual tripwire. So every time the mouse runs past this tripwire, we activate it, and worked really well, because every time we activated, the mouse started turning to one side, and it never actually ran towards the edge.
Mm.
And so by doing that, we actually prevented the animal from running to the edge. He could do everything else except during this little bit period of time, didn't run to the edge. And when we did this, they didn't learn to go around the obstacle. So whenever we stimulated, whenever we threatened the animal with the obstacle, they always ran straight at the obstacle. Even though they had spent a lot of time sniffing the edge and doing everything else, they just hadn't run to the edge. And that's kind of a causal evidence that they do need these runs. That was a particularly fun experiment, because it also, we're basically hacking into the brain, into, this was in this case was the motor cortex, to change behavior.
Yeah.
And we got into a lot of discussion about this. This doesn't mean that the motor cortex has anything to do with learning the behavior, even though we messed up the activity of M2. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but that's not the point. What we're using optogenetics for was to perturb behavior. Right, and that's an interesting distinction,
yeah.
Which is fun, which is, I quite like that experiment actually, because, you know, we could have done it, we did it in M2, we could have done it in the spinal cord, we could have done it anywhere.
Yeah, it's like perturbing behavior to study behavior.
Correct,
rather than
exactly.
Trying to find a neural circuit.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Which
I've not heard of before.
Which was fun, and it worked, so that was quite fun.
Amazing. Yeah.
Very cool. I was reading one of your reviews on threat responses and the involvement of the periaqueductal gray area. And in that review, it was outlined the differences between how the brain processes imminent threats versus slower onset threats or attacks, and how this could be because of synaptic mechanisms of like sort of thresholding of different inputs. Could you tell us a little bit about how imminent threats responses are distinct in terms of the neural mechanisms?
In terms of behavior, right? The difference between an imminent threat and a threat that is not so imminent is that you really need to act on it, right? If
mm-hmm.
something's coming at you really fast, you need to get out of the way. And you don't even need to know what that thing is. You just really want to get out of the way. And so for something that's visual, for example, the fastest route is, you know, from the retina straight to the supraoculicus. In a mouse, actually 80% of the input from the retina goes to the supraoculicus, and from there it goes to the midbrain, the periaqueductal gray, activates the periaqueductal gray, and then the mesencephalic region, the cuneiform nucleus, and then the animal escapes. That's past this neural pathway to go from a stimulus, from a threat to an escape. Now, if things are not as imminent, we should also have to think about how does the nervous system define something as imminent? And again, in the case of a looming stimulus and that's approaching quickly, very fast, there will be detectors in the retina that do that, and they're hardwired to parts of the colliculus that are themselves then hardwired to the whole escape circuit, and that's how it works. For other things that are not so imminent, then you can use the whole brain. basically, you know, the typical thing of something that is not as, you know, a class of threats that is very non-imminent are odors, for example. Odors are very different, right? A predator odor tells the animal that there might be a predator in the vicinity, or there was a predator in the vicinity, but doesn't necessarily require immediate action.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, you might engage circuits that are important for recognizing what this predator might be, such as the amygdala, for example. And then, depending on that, and maybe integration of other cues, for example, maybe you smell something and you activate that. Through the VNO to the vomeronasal organ, for example, that detects pheromones, and you activate the amygdala, that maybe say the amygdala projects in the parietal gray, so say the amygdala tickles the parietal gray, but it doesn't really make the parietal gray fire a whole escape response, but maybe increases the excitability. But then you hear, maybe you see something that maybe resembles a predator. You're not quite sure, but then you might use your visual cortex to process that against some expectation of what a predator is. And maybe then you hear a little twig of something that gets parsed by your auditory cortex. And all of these things make their way to the parietal brain. And they're eventually integrated to generate an escape response. The difference is that in one case you have this direct path that goes bang, in the other one you have a bunch of different things that might be parsed by sensory, the sensory streams might be parsed by different parts of the brain that eventually make their way to bring this defensive circuit to crash or not. You have, of course, escape is not the only defensive action that an animal can do. Another one is freezing, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And freezing has a lower sensory threshold, so animals would normally freeze. In terms of freeze before escape, there's this well-known relationship between the imminence of the threat and the defensive response. And if the threat is present but is not very imminent, animals will tend to freeze first and then will eventually escape. And so in this model that I'm telling you about, I think that most of the input that gets fed into the escape circuit will also get fed to the freezing circuit almost certainly. These systems will actually probably first activate the freezing circuit, then will first freeze, and then if you have additional input, so you know, you're in some sort of state of alertness, maybe you're freezing, and then another sensory input comes, you go. But the parts of the brain that are involved in this then can be many and depend a lot on the nature of the sensory stimulus.
Mm-hmm. But it's ultimately like sensory integration.
Sensory integration, that's what it is, right? Paired with some internal state of expectation or anxiety that if an animal has experienced threat recently, it will decrease the threshold for engaging in another defensive action. That means the sensitivity to threat is increased.
Mm-hmm.
Because now like, ooh, I'm in a bad place, there's predators around, so now I'm going to be more reactive to that. Right? And so the mechanisms for that can be many, right? But it's all about how excitable your escape system is, or your freezing system is, in response to the sensory input. So the sensory inputs are still the same, but now they might generate a defensive response more efficiently than before that previous experience of threat, and that can happen because maybe you've sensitized the increase the excitability of the escape circuit, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And is that caused by activity in higher order brain regions, like the prefrontal cortex or hippocampus?
It could be. So the prefrontal cortex actually projects straight to the parietal, right? That could be one mechanism. I think there's some the parietal race exhibit from half of the brain.
Yeah.
But I think probably not by accident, right? Because you might want to link the prefrontal cortex to the defense system because you want to use whatever the prefrontal cortex computes or the expectations that it computes to inform the defensive system and tell the defensive system, pay attention to there's this feature of the environment that might mean that we're in a dangerous place, let's increase it. But then you might want to use some other circuits that performs a parallel computation about the environment and draw some sort of a value estimation of the environment, again saying, oh, this is a bad place to also feed into the parietal gray. So I think that can come. So all of these systems, many assets, the prefrontal cortex is a great example because the prefrontal cortex clearly evolved way later than the parietal gray, and animals escaped. As soon as animals could move, they escaped, right? Because there's always been predators around. So I think that you have this basic mechanism to compute defensive behavior, and then you, as evolution goes and invented all these other things that can compute more sophisticated stuff, there's always also an interest of hooking these regions to the primordial regions that control behavior. In this case, escape behavior, but also hunting behavior or prison behavior, and so that's how we think about it. But I think actually, I think it's perfectly possible that this just basic system between, say, the supercritical nervous and the parietal gray, actually, there's a lot of circuitry there. There's a lot of inhibition, there's a lot of neuromodulation. I think there's enough circuitry there that things like changing the sensitivity to threat in an experience-dependent manner can actually be computed without the rest of the brain.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I hadn't thought of it before, that maybe these regions that developed later that are seen as higher order and more human-specific just had to find their way to connect to these more primitive regions but aren't essential for the constitution.
That's how I think about it. It's a very simplistic view of the brain. But, it's a fact that if you look throughout evolution, things like the supraumbilicus or the object tectum and the arcticular gray are present in the lamprey. That's 500 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the basic functionality was there. But then as other things evolve, things like the midbrain, everything goes through there, right? Because in fact, eventually, the output of all of these things is moving, right?
Yeah.
It's going from one place to another, eventually, right? So whatever it is that all these fancy systems compute, they have to exert their influence by influencing the effector circuits. So they have to be connected one way or another, either directly or indirectly by the basal ganglia, for example. To these effector circuits, and so, but I think that in my very simplistic view of the brain, things like the prefrontal cortex evolved to do really fancy computations, but then we need to output that result of this computation somewhere in a way that affects behavior.
Yeah, and it's not like humans are better at escaping than, like, lampreys.
No, if you know, actually, when you're dealing with imminent threat, even in threat, probably not. I don't know.
We might overthink things a bit much.
Yes.
To spend too long thinking about our potential escape routes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So I wanted to go back to naturalistic behaviors again, just for a minute, and talk about not only naturalistic behaviors, but also challenges with setting up a behavioral paradigm, and any advice you may have for researchers who are now given the challenge to set up their own behavioral paradigm, because mice are a lot smarter than we think they are, and it's really difficult to find like something that's a bit more bulletproof and make sure that they're doing what we think they're doing, but also designing something that is also like simple enough for the mice to actually be able to do it. And it's all well and good having these fancy plans, but then if the mice doesn't get it, then everything falls apart.
I don't know, so I'm probably not the right person to answer that question, in the sense that I have very little experience in designing behavioral paradigms. So I guess it depends on, first you need to decide what you want out of a behavioral paradigm. What's the question? What is the behavior? What's the particular element of the behavior that you want to study? What's the, can you define the computation? And I think the problem you're alluding to is as humans, again, I have very little experience with this, but as humans, we design some behavioral paradigm that it is designed to be solved in a certain way, and then mice or animals will find a heuristic that baffles you, that, you know, maybe they didn't do the computation that you thought you were going to do because they just found a cheap way of doing it, right? And they're really good at it. That's always, I think, a risk, especially with mice, is certainly a risk, right? And sometimes I think it's quite hard a priori to see, you know, what those heuristics are. But there are a lot of people who have a lot of experience in this, right? I think like the approach we take is actually different in that we don't expect the animals to solve the challenges we give them in any particular way. You know, we just say, look, I'm going to scare you. I'm going to present a threat. Do whatever. Right. There's a shelter here, go there if you want to, please jump, do whatever you want, right? And then my job is to try to understand, you know, if they choose, you know, they can freeze or can they escape, can I understand the variables that determine whether they freeze or escape, for example. You know, a simple one is if you take the shelter away, they freeze. You put the shelter in, they escape. Okay, that's cool. But that's super simple, right? Yeah. And I don't know how, again, I don't go with a priori concept of what they're going to do or how they're going to do it, right? It's a different job. It's okay, I'm interested in the response of animals to trade. So the first thing I'm going to do is to define what their response is, come up with a behavioral model of how they do it, and then go into the brain, right? In some ways, it's kind of the problem with this approach that I'm telling you that we do is that if I'm interested in the particular aspect of spatial learning or something, chances are that the mice are not using it, right? And they're using whatever they do. So if you, this is why I say, if you want to isolate a specific computation, then you probably will have to design a very specific task designed to study and isolate that computation, right? Our approach is, all right, we're just interested in the behavior, and we're going to take whatever we can get, and we'll study that computation, right? And so I guess they're kind of two extremes in one, in some way. I don't know. They're just designed to probe different things. One is just a general behavioral problem. The other one is isolating something that you think is interesting, for whatever reason, and then you really want to make sure, you know, you have all these variables nailed and that your animal is actually solving it the way you want it to solve, because that's the way that engages the computation you're interested in. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting because they're kind of like different forms of reductionism, because in one hand, on one approach, you might be trying to like reduce all the other variables to just target the one thing you want to look at, and then for you, it's more like you're trying to avoid the influence of any interference you may be having by trying to isolate the one thing you're looking at.
Yeah, so. I mean, in some ways, it's like, okay, well, it's you decide, okay, I'm not going to isolate the variables. You start with accepting that the behavior is messy and complicated.
Yeah.
And you're just going to have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the criticism, fair, is that maybe you can't measure everything that matters, right? And it is messy, and maybe you think you're looking at some relationship between variable X and neural activity Y, but there's so many other things that are out of your control that you can't actually do that. And that's fair, right? So, but at least we set out from the start to embrace that problem.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas the risk of the, you know, a very reductionist approach is assuming you have control of the variables.
Mm.
But then you find out that you forgot about something else, that the mouse is wiggling its tail and you were not measuring the tail wiggles. I don't know, something like that, right?
Yeah.
So, but you know, in what we do, of course, we want to, you know, there's a reason why we just don't let an animal loose in the middle of a forest and try to behave on that.
Yeah.
Right? So we still have a very simple environment, right? The simplest possible that allows us to, that animal, to still express what we might consider an interesting behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Not behavior, right? So.
It's like how in psychology we study humans knowing that how like complex humans are, and so it's more similar to your approach actually. But then I feel like sometimes maybe humans underestimate the complexity in animals. Like, only now we're realizing all of these complex behaviors that mice can exhibit, and just like Caroline said, how smart mice can be. So there's more need for these like more naturalistic behaviors to be studied, in my opinion.
Again, it depends. Yeah, I think we need both, right?
Mm-hmm.
Definitely both. You need very controlled approaches, and I think it's also interesting to explore this space, right, and see how much we can learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's the conclusion that obviously it's too complicated, and why we need to really just do a very reductionist approach. But I think there's a middle ground there that I think is interesting,
mm-hmm.
and allows, especially with, you know, our ability to now quantify behavior of really moving animals, doing pose estimation, and I think that it's, life is a little bit easier now. It's not like, you know, 1950s where you go down to the beach with a notebook and just like write down, all right, the cheek has pecked two times. and that is complicated, right? You can't do much neurophysiology on that.
Yeah.
But I think now there's a middle ground where you can kind of bring some of the natural behavior into the lab under some control conditions, and then try to, it's about that, I think. It's about trying to come up with conditions that are as simple and as controllable as possible, that yet allow them to express some form of natural behavior that we find interesting. And then we go after that and try to quantify it. And again, the critical thing here is first spending time looking at the behavior and building models of behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that by the time you go into the brain, you have some idea of how the mouse is generating this behavior, and integrating variables from the environment or from its internal state to generate that particular behavioral choice. And if you have a model of that, then
yeah.
It's wrong, but at least you know what, you go into the brain looking for something.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's one way of doing it, but I think it's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to ask, from your varied past career, what is the most interesting thing that you have found, in your opinion?
The most interesting thing I've found?
I was going to ask something so similar.
Yeah. I thought, well, yeah, just replied.
I think that's good.
I really liked the research we did on dendrites and neurons. I think that was really very solid and very fundamental about how neurons work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that 100% convinced that neurons have these properties, and you know, the question is whether they use it or not. It's like, it's a very general thing, so in many ways it's quite satisfying, because I think it's a very fundamental property of neurons. But then after that, I think that, you know, the very first paper we published in the lab, which was just a behavioral paper on describing the basic escape behavior,
mm-hmm.
where we find, and I think that's probably the most interesting thing, that we find that when an animal escapes to a shelter, it does so because it memorizes the location of the shelter, not because it has to see where the shelter is. And that sets that makes these behaviors so much more complex and interesting than the mouse, the animal, just seeing, okay, I'm going to look around and I'm going to run to the red thing. That's one way of solving it, but they don't do that.
Yeah.
They remember where this red thing is, and they can use ability to locate in space to go to this red thing. That was quite surprising. And the fact that, you know, the very first experiment we did, we have this little red hut, we move it to the side and we scare the mouse, and the mouse runs to where it used to be, and the red thing is right next to it. Right? You can argue it's really dumb, but there's reasons why they might do that.
Yeah.
But I think that is super interesting, and it was kind of unexpected. It's such a robust thing that then just for us just set the scene for the next, I guess, 15 years of research.
Yeah, basically. And on that note, though, did you like put multiple huts and then see if it would go back to the same one?
Yeah, so we have a project ongoing with multiple huts. They can use, if we put tree, they can use the tree according to some heuristics that we're still trying to figure out. There's a huge influence of going back to the one that you previously visited, but then distance also plays a role.
Mm.
And so what we're doing right now is, again, doing what I just told you. We're building a model, a behavioral model, trying to can we come up with a behavioral model that explains, that predicts which hut the animal is going to go to, depending on a bunch of variables. So they can do that, and they can remember the location of the three of them. So we can have three, we take them out, there's no hut there, we scare them, they go to where one used to be, then another one, and then another one.
Mm-hmm.
So they can clearly keep these three locations in space, in memory,
yeah,
and use them together here. And I think that's probably my favorite kind of finding, because
mm-hmm.
It's super simple,
mm-hmm.
It's the simplest experiment in the world, but as I said, it has set kind of the scene for our last kind of 10, 15 years of research, and again, it's going to continue.
Yeah.
So that's quite fun.
Going, like, reflecting on what you said in the beginning of escape behavior being relatively simple, it really doesn't seem like that to me.
No, it's not actually.
It involves learning and memory.
It
and
does, actually. Actually, it's
internal
it's,
state
it's,
and context.
In some ways, yeah, I'm a bit annoyed. Actually, I thought, for example, that they would be able to do this in a very simple way, like, there's many ways you can navigate back to a home.
Mm-hmm.
And one way is just a purely egocentric way, where you just keep track of your position relative to a point of reference. And I thought, yeah, this is what they're going to do, and which means that maybe they can do it without annoying regions like the hippocampus. Right? No, they don't. So the hippocampus is probably important.
Yeah.
Then you're kind of the whole Western brain.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a bit more complicated than I hoped for, honestly, but it's still
yeah.
Fun.
Keeps it interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
Endless possibilities of different avenues to explore.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
So one more question,
yeah.
And this was actually a question asked by the audience. So the question is, what does solving the brain mean to you?
Solving the brain, goodness me.
To end on a light note, you know.
I mean, I guess the generic answer is having a model of the brain that predicts a certain outcome, predicts a correct outcome in conditions that hasn't seen before, right? But I think fundamentally, understanding something for me is having a model of how it works,
mm-hmm.
Right? And in order to test whether that model, the acid test of any model, is to see if it makes a correct prediction in conditions that it hasn't seen before. So I guess it's having a model of the brain. The question, and I think that's a very generic, agreeable answer. The question is then, at what level, what does that model look like,
mm-hmm.
Right? And that's kind of where I guess opinions will diverge highly, right? Is it circuit A? I mean, we know what the brain does, right? You can
mm-hmm.
have, it's like input comes in and something happens and something
behavior.
Comes out and
yeah.
behavior comes out, right? Okay, that's model one, right? And then you can say, okay, it goes to circuit A, circuit B, circuit C. Yeah, is that understanding? And you can go all the way down to whatever you want,
mm-hmm.
to the gating of glycine receptor. Do you need that? For me, I'd like to be able to explain. If you take escape, for example, I'd like to be able to describe exactly that. The stimulus comes, it goes through the retina, it activates the synapses, it goes through the cerebellum, it activates these neurons, and the escape neurons fire because they integrate input for all these reasons. And I can explain to you exactly the flow of information and the integration of information at any particular level, any node. But that's a personal thing, just because that's what I want to know. And again, you know, it depends on what you're going to do with once you have solved the brain. What do you want to do that? What are you going to do with information? Right? And you know, I guess there's two answers, right? One is that you need to use it to cure all brain ailments, right? And if you want to do that, then you'd probably want to know about molecules and synapses and things like this. Or it's just for your own personal
curiosity
and for advancing knowledge, right? And for that, there's no right answer, right? Maybe it's unrealistic to think that you can explain a mammalian brain at this level that I'm telling you about, because the whole thing is so complicated and distributed that maybe it's you can only understand it through dynamical systems approach and manifold edges or whatever. but I'm not, I mean, I'm saying this in joke, but I mean, it's possible, right?
Yeah.
It's true,
yeah.
Right? And so that's the question, right? I mean, a very complicated brain, probably, you can't explain it the way I want. It's impossible, almost surely.
Yeah.
So there's an argument then, if that's what you want, then you should study a simple brain that does interesting things.
But even studying a simple brain like C. elegans, where we've mapped the whole connectome, you know, we're still unsatisfied with the answers that we have.
Yeah, but anyway, I think it's having a model of how it works, right? I mean, I think that's a decent answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great answer. Thank you. So we'll wrap up the episode there. Thank you so much for joining us today, Tiago.
My pleasure. That's really fun.
Oh, I'm glad.
Yeah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for your questions and your interest.
That's
really fun.
A lot of big ideas discussed.
Exactly.
I really appreciate it. Yeah.
I like the perspective now that I have of escape behavior and how it relates to all of these really complex circuits.
And research approaches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please feel free to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at neuroverse_pod and our website neuroversepod.com for all of our resources.
Thank you for listening.
Today's episode was made possible thanks to the support of the Sainsbury Wellcome Centre Public Engagement Fund. We would like to thank Sainsbury Wellcome Centre for the generous grant supporting science communication initiatives like these.